This is John Quinn, and this is Law Disrupted. And today, we are going to be speaking with another attorney here in Los Angeles, Bethany Christovich, who's at the very distinguished and excellent law firm of Munger, Tolles & Olson. And Bethany has a very interesting practice. Probably not all she does, but I gather a significant part of what she does is representing lawyers, representing other lawyers, probably mostly in malpractice cases. And I've got to think, I have very limited experience representing lawyers, but I've got to think, and I think most people would think, boy, representing lawyers, that's got to be tough. One, you know, in our society, they're not necessarily the most beloved people and professionals, and maybe not easy to make likable. And second, I would think they have their own ideas, and you've got to try to give them advice which may not be consistent with what their own opinions and instincts are telling them. So, I mean, those are some, just facially, some of the challenges that it seems to me. And so let's begin by asking, what is it about, you know, representing lawyers that's different than representing other kinds of clients?
Sure. So both of your observations are true to an extent. I mean, they're definitely true. Whether there are ways you can sort of navigate around that is an interesting area for discussion. In terms of how representing lawyers is different, every case, it's not just one area of law, right? The alleged malpractice, because you're right, John, it is often alleged malpractice, comes up in any different context. So for example, it could be in the handling of a bankruptcy. It could be in the handling of a trust and estate case. Some of the best legal malpractice law comes out of the trust and estate context, where once the client passes away is often when the problems with the work are revealed. And so you get really interesting issues of standing and who has standing to sue the lawyers. And so one of my favorite things about it is that every case arises in a totally different context. So I get to do this thing that I know, John, you do with being a trial lawyer, where you're always learning, you're always...
Yeah, and you have to try, you're trying the case within the case.
Exactly, you're trying the case within the case, right.
There's been this underlying engagement, which may have been a litigation, it may even have been a trial, and somebody is saying that your client mishandled that. So you're kind of trying that underlying case. What happened? Would it even have made a difference if things had gone differently? And then did this lawyer exercise the appropriate level of professional care in the practice?
Right. So many things in what you just said that are absolutely right. You're trying the case within the case, meaning you don't only have to show that a lawyer fell below the standard of care, but you also have to show that it would have made a difference to an outcome. And so in essence, you're asking the jury to hold everything else constant and just tweak the lawyer's conduct to be what the plaintiff says it should have been. That's an incredibly, you know, and then dovetailing with your second point, John, about the standard of care, lawyers make mistakes just like everyone else does in their job. But to say to a jury, lawyers are not held to a standard of perfection is frankly a very difficult thing to do, because people do want their lawyers to you know, hit the mark in their representation. One of the hardest things about practicing law, I think, is that you are making decisions every day with imperfect information. So you make a decision about what witness to pursue, what order to take depositions, what documents to ask for. And then you get more information. So there's a lot of hindsight bias when it comes to this, that yeah, in hindsight, you do a lot of things differently. Figuring out how to tell that story from the vantage that the lawyers had at the time it's challenging, but it's also super fun.
Yeah. And lawyers are not, you know, especially litigators, I mean, they're not bashful people. They don't generally have fragile egos, or at least if they are fragile, they try to hide that from you.
Right.
And it's got to be not easy. Now, I've, you know, you get one in, you don't practice for as long as I've practiced, and not have somebody sometime accuse you of not handling something properly. In my experience, almost, I think the times that that's happened, almost 100% of the time, it's like a counterclaim in a collection action. It's a standard defense when you're trying to get paid. But I would think having somebody tell you, you know, you failed me here. You made a mistake and it made a big difference. Your clients must, they don't take to that easily, I would think. When you first meet them, they've got to be very defensive. They've got to be, you know, protecting their own egos, their own professional standing, their sense of themselves, which is being challenged by this claim. I mean, that's my speculation. A, is that true? B, how do you deal with it if it is true?
Sure. I would say it is true, and it is even more than it is true with me. It is true internally, right? Like, in other words, people may feel comfortable confessing their sins to an outside lawyer who's been brought in. They have a much harder time telling the person down the hall from them, who they may have internal, you know, political things with. But I always tell people that, you know, it does help that I do this for a living. And I can tell people, look, here's what I've seen before. Is that similar to what happened here? In other words, at this point, I have seen three or four archetypal stories, right? Of the client that you never should have had in the first place, the relationship that soured. You know, there are sort of three or four stories that get told. And if I can offer one to the client of like, look, I've seen this happen before. Is that kind of what went on here? And get them to talk back to me after I've said, look, this is a normal thing. This does happen from time to time. That can be big in getting the ego. I also let clients know that part of the reason that I chose this practice is because it makes me a much more humble lawyer. I mean, I see what lawyers go through. I see how they're having to navigate the business, the, you know, managing teams, the dealing with other case deadlines. And so telling them, look, I live this world. I understand it, does tend to help a lot. It's funny you mentioned that about the collections case. One of the things I oftentimes get asked about prophylactics, like what can you do to avoid these type cases? And I always tell them that like the number one issue is intake, meaning most of these situations are a client that like was not worthy of the lawyer from the outset. Like we saw this huge spike in cases in around 2010, 2011. And it was because a lot of firms were very hungry in 2008, 2009. And so they took on all kinds of cases that they shouldn't have taken on. But the second biggest prophylactic measure is getting a retainer and staying current on your billing and your collections, because it's when you start to go and try to collect 6-month-old bills, that's when, like you said, a lot of the complaints come out.
How often does it happen that you have a client that's just not open to the idea that they have some vulnerability, that they're absolutely convinced they did the right thing? The jury's going to see it's the right thing, and they're not open to any suggestion that they face some risk. Does that happen?
I would say usually, maybe this is a sign that I have some kind of like bad mark on my door. By the time things get to my door, people usually understand they have a situation. I also often frame it as, look, it's not that you did anything wrong. It's that we have all these headwinds against us, John, the ones you started with. They're like, here's how lawyers are perceived. Here's the standard they're held to. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying you did anything wrong. Oftentimes, I find that insurers can help with this. Like, look, the goal here isn't right, wrong. The goal is like, let's put this behind us. That said, there are certain times where I've had cases where plaintiffs wanted more than the law firm sort of net revenue. And it was like, look, you're just going to have to win this. We're not going to engage in a discussion with you about the kind of sums you're seeking. Usually the plaintiffs can come around, but you sometimes have to get trial ready in these cases.
So, I mean, to go back to my original question, how it's different. I mean, what would you say are the main things that distinguish this practice of representing lawyers from representing other kinds of clients?
Sure. There's a saying that I always think guides this. People hate lawyers, but they like their lawyer. And I think that it's different because people all have this expectation of lawyers. They all have an image of a lawyer in a way that they might not a lot of other roles. And so being able to understand where they're coming from and understand that they're going to think lawyers are just, you're responsible for getting everything right. But shifting the focus a little bit and thinking, is this the type of lawyer who I want representing me? And really humanizing your client can really help.
Yeah.
One of the other ways that this is different than other practices of law is, frankly, the complexity, the case within the case aspect that you noted. This isn't a simple, you know, what color was the light when the cars passed through the intersection? I mean, you really have to be willing to roll up your sleeves and get into the details. You have to understand, okay, if the I had one case where the underlying thing was an insider trading thing. I had to really get in the weeds and learn the insider trading thing. And so I think that the complexity of these cases can get high pretty quickly.
Is expert testimony important in these cases? I would think yes.
It is hugely important. And there comes this moment at every point, John, when I think, why do we have an expert in the law again?
Yeah, really. I mean, that's what strikes me. As we all know, usually you don't have experts to testify in court about what the law is, but you kind of do that in this practice area.
You definitely do in this practice area. And I go into these in limine hearings when we do have dueling experts in the law, and I'm waiting for one day a judge to say to me, Ms. Kristovich, I'm the expert in the law. So far, knock on wood, that has not happened. I think sometimes how I have reconciled it in my head, because usually you don't get experts in law, is it's almost like an advisory jury would be. You're asking the judge for sort of a hot tubbing of experts on this like really deep specialized area that the judge may not litigate in that frequently or have that much exposure. And so separating out the advocacy of me or the plaintiff's lawyer and having there be, you know, some sort of credentialed expert that the judge can engage with on what is this area of law. I do see that serving some benefit because I've had very technical specialized areas of underlying law that, again, I do have to master and get up to speed on, but I can see how it can be helpful to a judge. In addition to those, the damages experts in these cases are crazy because you have to redo the damages from the underlying litigation.
And that's all this kind of wild, hypothetical, speculative exercise.
Right.
If your client hadn't done X or had done Y, the result would have been Z.
Right. And how do you do that? Especially, I had one involving a jury trial in Texas. And how do we know what a jury would have done if X argument had been made? And so you're really asking that first jury to put themselves back in that situation and asking the second jury to put themselves in the situation of the first jury. And how do they do that without full-on expert testimony?
So why doesn't this just all fall under the heading, these are speculative damages? We can't entertain that.
That is an in limine, I would say, in probably 7 out of 10 cases, their damages are speculative, or at least some huge portion of them, because you're right, you're asking new jurors to put themselves in the shoes of old jurors. And then even when you don't have a jury verdict, it's, okay, what would the settlement offer have been? What would the government have done with respect to its fines or penalties if X, Y, or Z argument had been made? That's why, look, I know that lawyers tend to be hesitant to try these cases, but I have done several mock jury exercises where jurors will engage on that and they will start to engage on the causation. If you can normalize the conduct enough to make it where they're not mad, they will engage on some of the damages type issues.
Well, you've talked to a lot of people, a lot of mock jurors and a lot of jurors in jury selection process. About lawyers and having a lawyer as a client and a lawyer having allegedly made a mistake. What is your sense from that experience now about the degree to which jurors are prejudiced against lawyers, quick to assume they made mistakes, or are open-minded about listening that a lawyer, after all, as you said, if you go do a good job of humanizing him, is just another human being and things happen? And what's your sense of what people think about lawyers?
My sense is ultimately it's a popularity contest. They come in predisposed against certain lawyers. And this is the most delicate thing. You can't turn on your former client, right? You can't say, actually, they were just like a jackass and they never gave us any of the right information. I mean, you can't.
Oh, really? You can't.
It has to be very subtle. You have to just sort of let the person show themselves at deposition or in videos. You have to be incredibly nice.
Wait a second. If part of your defense would be the client didn't tell me about ABC, surely you can do that.
Yeah. Oh, if it's they didn't tell me, absolutely. If it's they made poor decisions all the time and they disregarded my advice and they had a sort of crummy business model from the beginning and this was a risk that I told them about, you have to distinguish between facts and whining is what I always say. Like you can't just whine about your former clients and say like, well, they weren't very responsive and they made bad decisions and they sort of engaged in a lot. You have to be very concrete with things like, I specifically told them not to do this and they did it anyway, which is fine. And you always have to be respectful. Like, that's their choice. But I, to the extent they think I didn't advise them of this, I did. And here's how I went about advising them. They elected to make a different choice. That's, of course, their preference. But you have to be very respectful and matter of fact about prior clients. Because one of the things I found is if you blame too much or if you whine about them, people will say, well, then why didn't you do something sooner?
Yeah.
It sort of comes back to you. But if you can make it a respectful, matter of fact point, and if you can point out, this is getting back to answering your question, if you can make the client look a little shady, and you look like you were always trying to give them upfront advice that just for whatever reason they wouldn't take, they'll wind up taking their predispositions about lawyers and shifting them to your former client.
But the privilege is out the window in this context, the privilege in the underlying case.
The privilege in the underlying case is out the window, which is one of the other things that I always tell lawyers, be very careful what you say about your clients in internal emails, because I grew up doing tobacco work. The worst documents I have ever seen have been in law firm work because lawyers think that all of their communications are privileged. And so they grouse about each other in internal emails. And you want to know what's really bad in a malpractice case is two lawyers from the same firm complaining about each other and the quality of their work.
All right. Well, I understand that the privileged communications between the client's lawyer in a malpractice case, that's all fair game. The lawyer can use that. But are you saying that if two lawyers in the law firm that's representing the plaintiff talk at all about the client, that the client's entitled to get that in the malpractice case?
I mean, again, it depends on the scope of the RFP, because you're not just limited to client file and discovery. You get the scope. So, John, let's say that a client made noise to you about saying, John, why did you make this decision? Nobody would ever do it to you. Let me make it a different hypothetical. Said, why did you make this decision? And let's say you asked two younger lawyers to, hey, can y'all pull for me the timeline of what we were doing here? And let's say one of them was just grumpy and started saying, why is he making us pull this? We all know it's his fault because blah, blah, blah. That's discoverable.
Okay. Well, your firm, I'm sure, like our firm, has a partner who's designated as the general counsel.
Yep.
And we kind of operate on the assumption, I hope you're going to tell me it's a fair, that it holds up, is that we can have communications with our general counsel for us to get advice about handling matters, and that privilege stands.
Absolutely. And that would stand. And so in my example, let's say there is a team of four lawyers working on a case, and two of them are complaining internally about one of the other ones saying God, did you see his argument? He was no good, whatever. That's not seeking advice from your general counsel, right?
Right.
But if your firm's general counsel is on it and you say, hey, lawyer, client raised this issue, they're unhappy, we're putting together a response, absolutely include the general counsel on that. And that is privileged. But if it's just two lawyers complaining, who hasn't complained about a colleague in their career?
Right.
But the notion that all of that could be subject to discovery in a malpractice action is, I think, bracing for a lot of lawyers.
Right. Well, what advice can you give to lawyers about protecting themselves? Use the word prophylactic. One thing I think you've told us is be very careful about bringing collection actions and getting retainers and make sure you're not in a position where you have to bring a collection action. The second is be careful what you say to each other. Are there any other things that you've learned from this practice?
Yeah. So one of the things, and this gets back, John, to how you started, which is that lawyers may bring their own ideas to things and could be seen as difficult clients. One of the things that I've learned, and I do this now not only in representing lawyers, but in all of my cases, is I try to have clients be a part of the decision-making process. And by that, I mean, hey, they asked us for an extension until Friday, inclined to give it to them, we'll do so unless you say otherwise. It's a 20-second email to write, but it keeps them in the loop. Of course, you're not going to get a malpractice extension about granting a discovery extension, but the point is, the more you bring clients into the loop with respect to decisions, I think the less likely you are to see second guessing of decisions later, even ones that on their face are just great decisions. And so I try to make it a point to anything of development that happens in a case, I just let the clients know. But I ask their permission, I ask their input on arguments. A lot of times they think, no, that looks good. But even if they don't, I think it is a helpful exercise to go through to keep them in the loop. A lot of times I'm doing these things and I say, and I'll do panels with insurance lawyers and they'll say, memorialize your advice to your clients in writing, especially when they disagree with you. Look, at our level of practice, clients don't necessarily want, like, I advised you that you should produce these documents.
Right. Yeah, this is just to confirm that we had a conversation and I told you the following.
Right, it's like a relationship killer.
It kind of suggests I don't trust, there's no trust here.
There's no trust here. And that it's a total relationship killer. And like, you can't practice law at our level assuming that like every case is going to go south or go sideways. It's just too destructive to the relationships. And so one of the things that I suggest to lawyers to do, but by the same token, you don't want everything to have been done on conference calls with no contemporaneous record, including because sometimes it's hard to go back and figure out what the hell happened here. So one of the things that I suggest doing is just sending a brief agenda before calls. It can just be bullet point outline. But that way, if you're going to cover, you know, scope of RFP responses or what documents are we producing or discuss an arbitrary choice, a jury is then going to believe you later when you say, look, we talked about it on the phone call. And then after that phone call, I didn't produce the documents or I did provide this discovery response. In other words, if you can create little like breadcrumbs along the way, which is, again, part of bringing the clients into the decision-making. So I think agendas, notes of calls, things like that can be way better than like CYA minutes. Don't make the only time you memorialize legal advice when they disagree with it, right? Like that's just a bad fact, but make it just part of your pattern and practice to keep them in the loop. And then when problems do emerge, this is to your other point about lawyers tend to be a very ego-driven and type A bunch. There's a tendency to either confess and say we're sorry or deny that anything went wrong and immediately. Neither of those is the best instinct. Like at that point, get your firm counsel involved. Don't say things that aren't 100% right. Because like in any other case, if you start just talking and saying, well, you told me to do this and blah, 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 blah. And then it turns out that that's a little bit inconsistent with the defense at trial.
Yeah.
It's a total disaster.
Right. When you're representing a lawyer or a law firm, I guess sometimes your clients are individual lawyers and sometimes they're the law firm itself and sometimes both. Does, when it's a large firm or a firm like yours or a firm like ours, to what degree is the law firm itself, as opposed to the individual lawyer, a player in the trial and how things play out? I mean, one of the reasons I ask is I'm sure plaintiffs bring a claim against your firm, our firm, they go to the website. Our website's not bashful. About in our world, in this day and age, we try to say nice things about ourselves and what we can do for clients. I assume all that gets quoted back in courtrooms.
It all gets quoted back. Let me say it this way. I've never had a case where I don't accept the heightened standard of care of an expert, right? I mean, because it all gets quoted back and you don't want to run from that at the rates that a lot of big firms charge. I would say typically it is the firm that is at least the primary defendant. One of the unfortunate things that I've seen happen is individuals will be named for what I'll call jurisdictional purposes, either to create diversity or defeat diversity, and they'll name individual lawyers. Look, I'm about as aggressive as they come in no holds barred litigation. I hate it when I see it because it really does have an effect on people's practice long term, especially if it's a case that hangs out for a long time and all of their partners know about it, their future clients know about it. And it's, look, I love being a lawyer and I think it's an incredible privilege. You hate it when you see somebody had, you know, a very storied career and then one relationship went sideways and, you know, it just never picks back up at the same level again. And I hate that. And I also think that as things have gotten more transactional, you'll sometimes have clients say, what do you care? You have insurance. And I don't think they quite understand the importance of reputation to lawyers and that being seen as somebody who engaged in malpractice is just not.
Or what the lawsuit will do to your premiums and your insurability in the very near future.
Exactly. The what do you care you have insurance? It's like, okay, you've never practiced law.
So at trial, when there's, do you typically have the individual lawyer at counsel table and some kind of representative from the firm?
Yes, and that's sensitive. I think it's important to have someone from the firm there. That said, some firms don't. You have to also think about how they're going to present. And especially how you're being portrayed.
So do you sometimes have this conversation with the law firm like, I don't think that person, do you have somebody else?
Yes, keep coming with the casting. Now, the day after the Oscars, yes. Sometimes you do think, like, do you have someone who presents a little less fancy? Because look, sometimes what's really attractive to a law firm full of lawyers is, you know, external signs of success that do not scream salt
like
of the earth.
The Rolex.
The Rolex, the white cuffs, the suspenders, all of the above. And again, those things all have their place in meeting rooms, but maybe not at counsel table. But then I do think it's really important to have the lawyer, or in some cases it's the lawyers, like the team who were practicing on the case. They're maybe not, you know, if it's a two-week trial, maybe not the whole time, but certainly for key parts of it. I think that's really important that the jury get to know and like them. The one thing I will say, though, is sometimes they are psychologically just messed up by this. And sometimes you just think that, hey, if it's going to be worse to have you there because you look like distraught, you know, and again, we do a lot of like witness counseling and we try to be thoughtful about the image that we're sending. You know, it's funny, but I think you'll appreciate this. One of the things that I've seen, I learned this very early in my career. If a lawyer at their deposition does not know his or her billing rate, that's way worse than having a high billing rate. And so just little things like that, right. People think there's an arrogance and they don't understand how law firms work. You don't always know your rate in any given matter and there can be discounts.
You'd be amazed how often they quote it wrong. They quote it wrong.
You know, there's this one had a freeze, that one had a random discount, get involved. And so lawyers might not always know what their quote rate is. And it's funny, that sends a jury through the roof more than just about anything else. Right. They think it's just a sign of arrogance.
Yeah. I'll bet they always get the question at deposition, is there anything, reflecting back on this whole experience, is there anything that you would have done differently? And the temptation has got to be to say, I wish I'd never accepted this client.
Well, there's that.
But you can't say that.
But look, absolutely. And we always tell people, you don't want to answer that question, oh God, let me give you the laundry list. But you also don't want to answer that question by being like, nope, I did nothing wrong and I give myself an A+.
Right.
And so figuring out how to say, you know, look, in hindsight, I could have done X, Y, or Z, but again, I think we did a great job here is, you know, it's interesting. It's a lot like medical malpractice. I'm not saying there aren't errors made, but the correlation between errors and poor outcomes, I think, is a very noisy correlation at best. And the ironic thing is that in a lot of these cases, when I look at the results that the clients got, I think, wait, you're suing for malpractice, right. You know? Because they're not all that bad, given sort of how things could have been.
Right. Do you have a sense that this is a practice area is growing, that more claims over time are being brought against lawyers and law firms?
Yeah, unfortunately, what we see from all of the insurance data suggests that these claims are just increasing. And not only are they increasing in numbers, but I think you're seeing more and more like 9-figure claims, frankly. I remember when I started in 2006, 2007, I was handling a $20 million case. And I was, you know, the first year associate on it. And that was just gigantic against a law firm. And now we see just cases like that pretty routinely. And usually once a year or more, we'll have one that is in the 9 figures. Those are hard cases for law firms to deal with because law firms don't have the balance sheets that, you know, a Fortune 100 company would have. And so, you know, if you were to do a risk probability analysis, which again, I understand not everyone likes to do, you know, a 20% chance of losing a $100 million case or claim is worth $20 million. I mean, that's not the right way to think about it, but it's a big risk factor for these law firms.
Right. Why do you think that this more of these claims are being brought?
So a couple of things. One, I think that there are more and more sophisticated things being done in the American economy than before. In other words, you look at sort of the whole SPAC deal, you look at the crypto, you look at financing. There are more and more things where lawyers are being asked to construct something new, right? Look at private equity in healthcare, in now like the HVAC space. I mean, there are just more and more sort of expansions and like just new things are developing. I think that's great for the American economy that we continue to be, you know, a fount of innovation. I think it's hard for lawyers, right? Because you think you've done something before, but it's a little bit different. And there's more opportunities for mistakes when that happen. I think there have been in the last, call it 12 years between the housing crisis and then COVID, two pretty big shocks to the economy. And anytime you have shocks to the economy, you are going to have some bad outcomes. And anytime you have bad outcomes, people can look to lawyers. I also think, and this is more of my personal view on something and less of something that I could point to, that I think there's a lot more lateral partner movement. And it comes with a lot of expectations. People want to deliver on certain size books of business, and they may not know their partners as well. And so I think that can tend to lead to just a little bit of what I call gripping, like you're holding on to clients a little bit longer than you should. Maybe you may be a little less likely to bring in new people when problems start to develop, and problems always get bigger when you try to paper over them. But I think the sort of innovation in the economy, the trouble in the economy, and just the law firms starting to behave more economically with the movement, those are all factors that I see.
How did you get into this line of work originally?
Sure. So when I started at the law firm, I graduated in 2005, clerked until 2006. I went and I was a public defender in New Orleans for a couple of months because Hurricane Katrina had happened when I was clerking, and I wanted to be a trial lawyer and a stand-up lawyer. And I'm from Louisiana. And so I did that for a couple of months. I started the firm. I thought, okay, I'm just going to do this to pay my loans. I would never want to be a corporate lawyer forever. My very first assignment was a legal malpractice case with Ron Olson and Kevin Allred, who's still at the firm. And I thought, God, did I just get the most boring case ever? It's legal malpractice. I should have started sooner. All the good assignments have been taken. But I totally loved it. And I loved my client. He was this old New York general counsel who was managing the case for the law firm. And he was just a riot. The opposing lawyer was something to deal with, I'll put it that way. And I just had so much fun. And I liked the case within the case aspect. I like working for lawyers. They're very rational actors. And so it's so fun. And so I think ever since then, I've had a case or two on the docket. I had my second case was for a law firm named Sedgwick, which is now defunct, not my doing, I swear. I wrote a demur as a first-year lawyer arguing that the statute of limitations barred the claim. They're such good clients. I wrote the demur. The demur was successful. I was not allowed to argue that because I was, a first-year lawyer. By the time the case went up on appeal, I was a third year, and they let me argue the case at the California Court of Appeal, which I thought was just an incredibly cool thing to do, and not a lot of mid-level at that point associates are getting to do it. So I've been doing it ever since. And I will say some of my best friends in the practice have come through other law firms.
Sounds like you enjoy it, and you enjoy it in large part because of the personal relationships that you're able to develop with your clients.
Absolutely. And look, that is not only, I will say that this aspect of representing law firms and the things I like about it has very much spilled over into my other, sort of crisis type cases. And I think that for someone who grew up an introvert, actually getting to like know other lawyers and getting to work with them and then getting to know people on the client side, I never thought that that would be my favorite part of the job, but it is by far.
Thank you so much for being with us, Bethany. This has been very interesting. We've been speaking with Bethany Kristovich of the Munger, Tolles & Olson firm about her kind of unique practice of representing lawyers in malpractice cases. This is John Quinn, and this has been Law Disrupted. Thank you for listening to Law Disrupted with me, John Quinn. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave a rating and review on your chosen podcast app. To stay up to date with the latest episodes, you can sign up for email alerts at our website, law-disrupted.fm, or follow me on X at JBQLaw or at Quinn Emanuel. Thank you for tuning in.